Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Chelsea Echo and welcome to your preview for West Ham away. Not a very happy hunting ground for Chelsea over the past few years, but hopefully just listening to this podcast can change our fortunes. Because if you do that and you give us a five-star review, Mystic Meg suggests that it means it's five goals for Chelsea. So 3 5-star reviews, 15-0. I'll be happy. So will Dan. But we'll jump straight into it. Let's talk about the game. Daniel! Big, big game for Chelsea after maybe a bit of a... I want to say it was a fiery affair, but it really didn't feel like it watching the game against Bournemouth. And it wasn't exactly the most entertaining, shall we say, until Nkunku scored. But with 14 yellow cards, probably one of... Actually, it might be more. I think it was 16 more yellow cards for Chelsea to replace the Battle of the Bridge as the most ill-behaved fixture in Premier League history. Hopefully, can Chelsea be good boys and just get the result we need without picking up so many yellows?
Well, Taylor isn't there, so that's probably a good start. I feel like that's probably the first ingredient that will probably help Chelsea in this aspect. Yeah, it was a very bizarre game because, you know, last week we were talking a lot about like Barclays men and like Premier League vibes and, you know, what is traditional Premier League. Like Bournemouth-Chelsea is like the last game, one of the last games you'd ever like put down as like that's going to be your fiery affair. Like it almost was like, but no, it's not good. That this is not the genre of game this is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a nicely contested game where Chelsea or Bournemouth win in the end. Usually Bournemouth, actually, but you know, so on this occasion, I think actually the Taylor antics actually swayed it back in Chelsea's favour. So that's how we ended up winning, weirdly.
The game itself just wasn't the most entertaining. Robert Sanchez, I had listened to Final Score with the score as well, and the boys were saying that this is probably Robert Sanchez's best performance in a Chelsea shirt, obviously making the save after the massive calamity of an error, which led to the penalty.
It wasn't even his fault, so...
No, I mean, but then running directly into somebody maybe is your fault.
It's one of those where let's be fair to Sanchez, right? If he does nothing in that moment and Evan Nilsson just takes the ball round him and puts it into an empty net, are we sitting there and going, what is Sanchez doing?
Yeah, okay, fine. I'll let him off. Robert Sanchez made the save, did what he needed to do. A big win for Chelsea, I think, as well. People still seem very much on the fence with how we're going to do this season, which probably doesn't help with the massive, massive list of things off-field that are happening. But on the pitch, Chelsea seems to be picking up points and doing a bit better. I mean, Dan, despite all the stuff that's happening off the field, of course, there was a couple more bits from the Bournemouth game that were quite interesting. And maybe the performance wasn't great. I thought a great finish by Christopher Nkunku, who could potentially argue for a place in the starting 11 now. I think he's actually starting to put a bit of form together, but that's a conversation for later in the show. But I do want to touch on the man who got the Man of the Match award after 45 minutes. Jadon Sancho. Good performance by him, wasn't it, Dan?
Yeah, it really was. You know, I thought the biggest compliment I think you can give him is he looked like he'd been playing at Chelsea for a very long time. And that's always the sign of a very good player is when they kind of slot in quite seamlessly. Now, we know there was another left winger who had a very good start at Anfield quite recently in recent years who, you know, we thought, wow, here we go. And of course, his Chelsea career hasn't turned out that well. So a bit of context. But, you know, I think Sancho looked slick. He looked nimble with the ball at his feet. He looked like someone that was trying to input some direction into a game that looked pretty aimless for a lot of it. And of course, he's directly involved in the winner. So I think for Sancho's point of view, I also think he probably, as we suspected before, that left wing area is very much up for grabs now. You know, Mudryk has not put down his mark on that position. Neto... It's not that I listen, Neto is still very early on in his Chelsea career and I still think there's a lot for him to offer and we know he can play off the right as well, but for that area it's very much up for grabs. So I thought that Sancho asserted himself very well. And especially against a deeper block, he seemed to deal with that situation quite well. And given this is a guy as well, you've got to throw in the context of his recent history, who hasn't been playing a lot of football. He's kind of been outcast at Man United for about a year now. And although he played a lot for Borussia Dortmund, you know, maybe psychologically that was the move he probably wanted, right? I could assume that he probably wanted to be at Dortmund because it's kind of the place he's most happiest. That hasn't worked out for him, but he now has a new home, basically. You suspect he will be a permanent Chelsea player by this time next year. So he needs to now make this work. And for a start, it's good. It's good to see him combining well. I thought him and Cucurella actually combined quite well in the second half down that flank too. So positive start. It wasn't a great performance by any stretch of the imagination, but as you said, and I think it's absolutely right, it was a result that Chelsea absolutely needed. Chelsea need to put wins on the board. They need to stop putting points on the board, because that's what this season needs to be. It needs to be not a season of what ifs and maybe next year will be somewhere. It needs to be results on the table, points on the board. And I just hope, of course, that doesn't mean I want that performance replicated, because I think if that performance is replicated a number of times, Chelsea won't win. So it needs to be something more substantial to it. I still have deep concerns about our inability to control games. Like we look like a team who can't control games of football, which is not how Enzo Maresca was sold as a head coach. So that still needs a lot of work. I still think there are big question marks over key areas in the team. But you just hope that actually winning a game, coming through adversity, is something that can, you know, brings a bit of spirit to the dressing room, brings a bit of unity, brings a bit of chemistry, and hopefully sets them on their way for a better run.
Yeah, I think that's definitely what Chelsea fans want. I think you've laid it out very well. Maresca was sold, obviously, as, you know, this possession-based coach. And that's obviously what the sporting directors are very keen on having as well. They want to have, you know, the Manchester City-esque style way of playing football. And if Chelsea can't control games, that's not going to happen. So it's going to be interesting to see how that expands and how that goes, especially with, you know, the players that Chelsea are missing. And even when those players come back, how they fit into the side. But with all that being said, we probably should touch on West Ham and get straight into the preview. But before we get into that, it's very important that you guys have a bit of context and get the numbers behind Chelsea's trip to the London Stadium. Ladies and gentlemen, it's that time of the day. It's Stat Shaggers.
The Chelsea Echo presents Stat Shaggers.
Yes, it's Stat Shaggers again. We're back for the latest instalment of Chelsea's stats before their latest game. This time, of course, against West Ham United. Chelsea, as you will hear very shortly, not great record against them recently. Played 122 in total, though, won 55, drawn 23, and lost 44 against the Hammers, so it's pretty tight overall. And Chelsea's recent clashes with West Ham, they've largely been a home success story, really. In the last three seasons, the home side has won all but one of the last six. Chelsea won 5-0 last season at home, 2-1 and 1-0 the other two in the last three seasons. West Ham last year won 3-1 at the London Stadium, drew one all the year before that, and won 3-2 two seasons ago. So, as I said, only one fixture that hasn't been a victory for the home side in the last six. The last time an away side won this fixture was Chelsea in April 2021, when Timo Werner netted in the 43rd minute in a 1-0 win. Since the Hammers moved from Upton Park to the London Stadium, that is one of only Chelsea's two wins in nine matches in all competitions against West Ham there. Also winning 2-1 in March of 2017, thanks to goals from Eden Hazard and Diego Costa. Overall, it's not been a happy hunting ground for the Blues of late, but this may be a good time to play West Ham, obviously with a new manager and not a brilliant start to their season. Onto the managers, we are back to Mr. Enzo Maresca, having never previously managed against West Ham, though he does have two wins from two against the Hammers under-21 side when he was at the Manchester City's under-23s. So there you go, but another new opposition and stadium for Maresca in what will be, as we've discussed previously, a familiar pattern throughout this season. In the opposite dugout is Julian Lopetegui, who himself is new to the role following his appointment in the summer. He actually has a decent record against Chelsea. He's won two of his five matches against the Blues. That included a 2-1 win with Porto back in September 2015, and actually a 1-0 win in his only Premier League game against Chelsea at Molineux with Wolves in April 2023. I'm sure Louis will talk about his win at Molineux any second now after I mentioned that stadium. He did even manage actually against Chelsea during our second Champions League win, drawing 0-0 at the Bridge before Olivier Giroud scored all four goals in a 4-0 thrashing away from home for Chelsea. Of course, that was when Lopetegui was managing Sevilla, where he did actually win the Europa League eventually. So there you go. That's this week's Stat Shaggers. And it's back to you in the studio.
The Chelsea Echo presents Stat Shaggers.
Right, Dan, That's Stat Shaggers. What is it you like to say every week?
Numbers said were.
See, yes, Tom loves doing the stats, and we let him do it. It's like, you know, you get what you need, and then we can carry on being passion merchants, and then Tom can still be a passion merchant, but a nerdy passion merchant. It's great. He loves his numbers. He loves his spreadsheets. But with that being said, look, Chelsea's trip to London Stadium in the past few years, Dan, has not always been the happiest of places to go being a Chelsea fan, is it?
No, it's a very awkward stadium, and I think that given how poorly they started there, for a combination of things, I think slightly better recruitment, maybe the West Ham fans feeling more at home there. I think, you know, it was, given how toxic it was in that stadium at the very beginning with West Ham fans and their feeling towards their ownership, you know, it's quite staggering actually how much it's turned around. Like, it's not perfect, obviously, but, you know, they've had a few forays into Europe. They've won the Europa Conference League. There's obviously been a much better feeling of unity around that club. And I think, despite the change in coach, I think West Ham have always kind of been, you know, maybe this is slightly relevant to Chelsea and slightly relevant to what we spoke about last week. Like, there is an identity to West Ham of being a very good counter-attacking team. They are a team who are a threat of set pieces. They've got very durable players. They've got very physically dominant players. And I think that's what they are good at. So I don't know why you'd want to veer away from that, especially when you come up against superior opposition. And that's what always makes this test for Chelsea very difficult. In recent years, Chelsea have been undone by set pieces, have been undone on transition. I think Antonio, if you talk about players who've enjoyed their time against Chelsea more than Antonio, I think, you know, maybe you have to look at, of course, now Erling Haaland, who has the best time against every single club he comes up against. But there are a few players in recent years I have, you know, more fear against, you know, Antonio, especially at the London Stadium, maybe not away from home, but especially at the London Stadium. He seems to really thrive on these counter-attacking days where he, you know, is able to turn with the ball, face up against his opposing centre-back, and physically can be so imposing. So we know what's there. Jared Bowen, of course, is always a threat. He could have scored a couple, even though Chelsea battered West Ham at the Bridge back in May. He actually hit the crossbar a number of times in that game. So he's always a threat. Thomas Suchek too. Kudos is a very talented player. Of course, you know, you look at their recruitment over the summer, and they've brought in some interesting players. But I think the core of what West Ham are hasn't changed and probably shouldn't change, because it still seems to be impacting games in a positive way.
Yeah, I think this is the big thing with West Ham is, I did a show with TalkSport early doors this morning with Paul Ross, and we had a West Ham fan on, and he was talking about how West Ham are actually in a very similar position to Chelsea. So we're talking about the identity of the side, and he's saying Lopetegui's obviously brought in 9 new players. They're all very sexy names as well, which I think is something which you don't really, you know, cross with West Ham, especially in the David Moyes era. But they've brought in some good players from big clubs who are looking to sort of fit into the squad and do well. And the whole thing is trying to understand and adapt the identity. And a lot of people are just calling him a Spanish David Moyes. Geezer on this morning was he's calling him J-Lo, which is quite good. I don't know if the footballer age as well as she has. But, you know, with all of that, it is interesting to see, you know, like you said, you think West Ham, you do think about that durability. I still remember seeing Thomas Suchek in the 18-19 season playing for, was it Slavia Prague we played that season or Spartak? I think Slavia Prague.
He scored against us, didn't he?
He did. I thought it was excellent. He reminded me very much of a younger Nemanja Matic. And I've always been a big fan of him. And obviously, like you said, big threat of set pieces. West Ham continue to do well from set pieces as well. And this season, you know, they are adapting. They are getting better. But they still have those players to integrate. I think a big name which terrifies me is Nicholas Füllkrug. I think that what he did with Germany at the Euros was exceptional. And I think, you know, the role he played for that Dortmund side as they headed towards the Champions League final was excellent as well. He was a player who I think reminded me a lot of Olivier Giroud. And I was all over Chelsea hopefully going after him. But then I remembered he's older than 5 years old. So that was never going to happen. But, you know, they have brought in some players which I think I looked at it and thought, oh, interesting. I think Max Kilman's another one as well. Great signer by West Ham. Long contract, though, which would see him at the club until he's like 35 or 36. I think it was a 7-year deal. So that's interesting to say the least as well. But there have been some key players in that West Ham side who said over the years, Antonio, I think Emerson as well, obviously former Chelsea player, has come in and stepped up for them as well, and he's been fantastic. Whether or not he'll be available on Saturday is another question. But
another player to mention is, and I think it's quite a nice story, is Max Kilman.
Yeah.
And the reason I say this, Max Kilman, I think, is a very... I know you've been a fan of Kilman, haven't you, in recent years? And, you know, he seems like a decent signing, I think a smart signing, and I've already heard he's had some good performances. But the nice little, I think, subplot to Kilman's transfer is Maidenhead, where he originally came from, got $5 million from the deal.
Really?
And to Maidenhead, that money is huge, and there's hopes by the locals that that is going to fund a new stadium, which they desperately need. But it's just these things that, I guess, from a Premier League point of view, you don't think of. But, you know, from they released a statement when the deal went through, because of course to a National League Vanarama club, that makes a huge difference.
Massive.
So just a little bit of info, you know, only anecdotal, because I obviously follow Maidenhead. I've been to a couple games recently, and you speak to people who go there regularly and how much of a difference that money could make. But obviously now he's gone from the Vanarama, the National League, you know, all the way up to playing in the Premier League on a regular basis. And obviously, as I think, has proved a shrewd signing already, probably, for West Ham.
Absolutely. I think he was somebody I was looking at. I think he's a player who has a lot of quality. And obviously, you know, I looked at him for Chelsea very much to sort of not only come into the side. He's from Edgware as well. He's a Chelsea fan. He's somebody who he's English Ukrainian, so he could have helped out with Carlo Madrick as well. So there's that nice little things as well. But he's a player who I think is definitely a very shrewd signer by West Ham, and it kind of just elevates that mentality of that transitional period that we're seeing between Lopetegui and David Moyes, because like we're saying, we're talking about durability, good counter attack. David Moyes wasn't renowned for his tippy tappy football, was he? He was always around for saying keeping up with the Joneses when he was talking about Man United and whoever else. And very much the football, like you said, was durable, counter-attacking, direct. I feel like Max Kilman's like a nice marry-up between possession-based football and times gone by, where you'll have seen that direct football, because he has the physicality and the durability of a West Ham player. But he also, I feel, has the ball-playing ability of a player who could really take it to the next level. So be interested to see what we'll do with him. But, you know, this is a Chelsea podcast, not a West Ham podcast. And as much as there are players that we have mentioned there that we are big, big fans of, Dan, is that outside of Antonio, outside of these names, is there anybody there where you look at and go, they might cause a bit of a problem? Is that a problem area for Chelsea?
Well, I think it's, you know, I look at, I guess maybe you'd throw Kudos into there of kind of being quite an obvious name that you mentioned all the time. I still go back to set pieces, and in terms of transition, I still have deep concerns about Chelsea. It's kind of that middle area that you saw Bournemouth capitalise on. Bournemouth were very aggressive against Chelsea. They, you know, I think it was not just kind of the front quartet of Bournemouth attackers who I expected to press Chelsea high. It was also the midfield that went quite aggressive on Cole Palmer. And it's still that area that I'm quite concerned about, just structurally, where I think teams know that Chelsea are still a bit fragile in build-up. Mm. And you can pressure us into errors. And even, I mean, the Wesley Fofana error was an unenforced error. I mean, it wasn't even a pressurised error. Which is concerning. And I think it's still kind of in those moments where I'm looking at Chelsea and going, springing us, you know, hitting us on the counter is one of those bits where I'm like, I feel like a lot of teams can hurt Chelsea. And it just, I spoke about this a few weeks ago. I said, I think I may have said it last week. This is a game that concerns me, because I think I get back to kind of the basics of what concerns me against this current Chelsea team is counter-attacking teams, good transition teams. Mm. It was interesting. I got a comment on, because I stressed this in my review on my channel and my podcast after Bournemouth, and someone said to me,
"You've got a podcast. You're making
unfortunately, I also have a Substack as well. If you search Son of Chelsea Substack, Son of Chelsea on YouTube, any subscribe really does go a long way. But moving neatly back to my point, one of the comments I got on it was, "You're making too much of these transition opportunities. The chances Chelsea are giving away, it's not that big of a deal. You know, Man City and Arsenal give away opportunities." And again, I get back to, like, it's variance. Like, Man City and Arsenal and any good football team, even the best Chelsea teams, will give away opportunities. It's about the extent and the nature of those opportunities and the regularity of those opportunities. I'm not saying that even Thomas Tuchel's great team that won the Champions League gave away a few opportunities. That's not the point. It's again, it's being disingenuous. The nature of the opportunities Chelsea are giving away. I think actually Everton have conceded less shots than Chelsea so far this season. Chelsea are conceding a lot of opportunities. I think it's something like 50 chances we've given away, or 50 shots. Now, the quality of those shots is varied. I think in terms of XG against, we're actually not that terrible. But that's too much for a team. Again, I go back to, what is this team being presented as, being briefed as? It's a team that has to have a lot of the ball. It's a team that has to have a lot of possession and has to suffocate the opposition and limit their opportunities. We're not seeing that so far. Games are too much of a swing for me, where it's like, against Bournemouth, they hit the woodwork a couple of times. That game could have gone in a... They had a penalty that needed to be saved, and you can't rely on penalties being saved every week. So for me, it's too much of a swing of momentum at the moment. So it's why still at the moment you're kind of like, Chelsea absolutely have individual quality. Nkunku proved that. He's a game changer. We know Jadon Sancho can maybe provide that. We know Cole Palmer can do that. We know Noni Manawake can do that. But it's whether those individual moments can override what happens at the other end. Mm. And I know I'm probably going to keep repeating myself, but that is a problem. Like, that is something that will be targeted by opposing teams. And I could only imagine what a West Ham team on a good day could do against this Chelsea team. And that's what I think justifiably concerns me.
No, absolutely. And I mean, that's why West Ham got that last minute winner against Fulham as well. It was in transition. It was a counter-attack. It was strong football. And I'm just looking at the 11 that they could field. And then this is just the last team and the bench. You know, in terms of that defensive rigidity that we're touching on, Emerson, Kilman, Mavropanos, Wan-Bissaka, you know, these are four players who, you know, we talk about our players that could be game changers in those moments. Wan-Bissaka is arguably the best 1v1 defender in the league. You know, you listen to any pro who's played with him or played against him, he's a player that everyone always worries about, because defensively he's resolute, he's sound. Mavropanos had a great breakout season with West Ham after his move from Arsenal. Kim, we've already touched on. Emerson, we know about. You know, midfield, Rodriguez, Alvarez, two big units who, you know, we worry about maybe could just completely bully our midfield, which is a possibility. We've already mentioned Kudus, Suchek, Bowen, Antonio. Bench, you've got, Cresswell, Fabianski, Kufal, you know, the old guard, Danny Ings, Carlos Soler, who came from PSG, Somerville, Todibo, Lucas Paqueta didn't even start. You know, we're talking about teams on transition who can attack us and hurt us. You're absolutely right, you know, and that middle of the park area, which you touched on. I mean, I do worry about Rodriguez and Alvarez, because they're two big players who can really, really push our players about and really help West Ham, you know, probably have a lot more shots than we'd like them to have. As you're saying, Everton already have faced less shots than Chelsea this season. And you know, it's a case of, like you've said, I think my worry is, you talk about the individual moments. This season so far has felt very much to me similar to maybe Jurgen Klopp's first 18 months at Liverpool before they signed Virgil van Dijk. You know, there was that element of, this is a team that can score goals, this is a team that can hurt you, but you can also really hurt them at the other end. And it comes back to the age-old football, not euphemism, that's the wrong word. What am I looking for? Dan, help me.
Cliche.
That's the one. Not a cliche, but it's a rule to live by as well. Listen, goals win your games, defences win your titles. And as much as we're looking at this Chelsea defence and they're bedding together, they're getting better, you know, they are still quite fragile. And I do think, you know, if you have Thomas Suchek, yeah, Edson Alvarez, You've got, obviously, Guido Rodriguez as well, who's a big boy that just signed from Real Betis. You know, these are not Antonio, we've already mentioned as well. These are not little guys. Now, this is still a side which is, despite being in transition from the David Moyes era of football, still has that element of physicality to their game. And that is something which Chelsea...
And I'd also point out that it's slightly strange, because individually I can pinpoint good players within our defence or defensive structure. Like Levi Colwell, I wrote a long Substack about it, and others have as well. Like Levi... from a passing point of view, is a major part and figure in the way Chelsea are looking to construct play. And it's quite encouraging to see and to look at examples of the way he builds up and the way he's contributing to that, right? And individually, I think defensively, he's doing his part well. But then you're next to a guy, Wesley Fofana, who basically passes the ball into a really dangerous area and helps to give away a penalty that nearly cost you the game. Moises Caicedo, I thought, had a brilliant game individually against Bournemouth. He had to do so much work. And the incredible thing is, he didn't get a yellow card, which is maddening to me. In that nature of a game, in what he's expected to do, in terms of what you want from a defensive midfielder individually, I thought he had a really good game. I actually think Renato Vega got better as the game went on. I thought he adjusted to what was expected of him in a central midfield role a lot better. And I actually think he maybe offered a bit more protection than Enzo Fernandez does in that role, right? But it gets back to that consistent thing we speak about with this Chelsea squad and its construction, is individually you can pick out good moments and things that players bring to the table, but do they actually function as a cohesive unit together? Is the balance right there? It's not to say that Chelsea just have a load of rubbish players. That's always a stupid way to look at things. But it's also naive to go, just because you have a bunch of good individuals, that doesn't always, and names that you put on a sheet, that doesn't mean they're going to function together with good chemistry. I still think that I'm more positive than negative, weirdly, on it, because I still am more excited to watch Christopher Nkunku. I think I think Christopher Nkunku is a level raiser in this Chelsea team. I think he makes a huge difference to this Chelsea team. I'm staggered, in the last two league games, it's taken Maresca so long to bring him off the bench. Because you saw in that moment, as much as I'll give credit to Sancho, for me, against tight defences, it's a problem we've had with our attack for years, right? What happens when a team drops deep, you know, suffocate space, and we need a player who's going to be confident in those tight areas? For me, Nkunku comes alive in those positions. We've seen it multiple times, despite the fact that he hasn't played a lot of football for Chelsea. Think about the goal against Wolves, you think about the goal against Liverpool, you think about the goal against Brighton, you think about the goal last weekend. He is someone that, when he gets into those positions, looks a level above anyone else in the team. And I'd even argue slightly better and more comfortable than even Cole Palmer. Because, you know, Palmer's incredible, but Palmer is someone that floats around the box. He can be a creator. He kind of ghosts in. Nkunku is much more of a guy who I think wants to confront players and get stuck in the mud a little bit more, if that makes sense. Like I think he's happy to get in that physical confrontation. Palmer can be the one contributing, and he does what he does amazingly. But yeah, for me, Palmer and Nkunku both have to be starting regularly for Chelsea. Does that mean I think the big question for this game is, does that mean you sacrifice Nicholas Jackson, who I still think does a lot of great, selfless, tireless work for the team? And it's kind of, are you losing something then by not having him in the team because of what he offers and adds to create space for others? I thought that was always a big conversation we had last year, was when I think you really noticed in that month when Jackson was away for AFCON, you actually really noticed he wasn't there, but also Nkunku wasn't there. So Nkunku now being there as a centre forward, maybe in this system, because you want to have Sancho probably in the starting 11. I expect most people will want to have Palmer. Even though he didn't have a great game, Madueke still feels like a player you want to have in a starting lineup. And it's something that we've talked about before. If Nkunku's playing, he has to be more central. I don't want him thrown out to the wide, you know, right or left, because it just seems like a waste of time.
With Nkunku being more central, you know, it's a great problem that Chelsea have now, because we actually have an abundance of talent, when last year we were in a position where we were uncertain that that would be the case, where we didn't know who was going to play, where if someone got injured, as you mentioned, you know, Nicholas Jackson goes to AFCON, we don't have Christopher Nkunku, who's leading the line for Chelsea? What's the situation? And, you know, it's a great problem to have, but I just can't imagine Cole Palmer being out wide now with how well Madueke is performing at the moment. You know, look, it might be a purple patch and we're having a different conversation in 6 months' time, but, you know, he's really stepped up a gear for Chelsea so far this season, and I've been very impressed for him on England duty as well. So, you know, I just don't know where Nkunku fits, because Nico Jackson feels very much like a player, like we touched on last week, is someone who will win those battles that allows other players to flourish. You know, I don't know if Christopher Nkunku's that guy. I feel like he's someone who has to play off of somebody, but then if he's playing off of Nicholas Jackson, you're losing that number 10. So who comes out of the side? How do you shape it up? You know, it's a really interesting case. But we've mentioned Christopher Nkunku. I want to circle back quickly to Levi Colwill, because I had a question for you as you were talking about how good he is. And this feeds nicely into our predicted 11 as well, because Chelsea are potentially going to be without Mauro Gusto. He might be back, they're not certain yet. And obviously Reece James has been ruled out for an extended period. I did a show with Alex Goldberg last week, and I've been told to keep a very keen eye on Levi Colwill. Now, you mentioned, of course, that he was a player who you could see Chelsea relying on now, looking to develop, see him as somebody who, you know, is going to be part of the team going forward for in a very strong way. Reece James remains out injured, club captain, unable to have any impetus on situations on the pitch. Chelsea look like they're in a very tough position and a predicament in terms of leaders in that Chelsea team. I was told that Levi Colwill was potential captain material. Jury's still out for me. That's my personal opinion. You're talking about how important he is to this side. Do you feel like Levi Colwill is somebody that, if he was handed the armband against West Ham, could carry it well enough?
Yeah, the problem is there's a vacuum. There's no obvious answers at the moment. That's the problem you've got, and it's the problem maybe that's been created by the recruitment strategy, or just because we've sold someone who was our captain last year, who I think was a suitable captain. So, to me, it's a sensible choice. I still have some concerns about Colwill, and they're more to do with maybe age and wisdom and just him getting more reps regularly in as a centre-back at Chelsea. But I have no problem with him taking that armband, and I think he could develop into that authoritative figure as he gets more experience. The problem you've got is that, of course, Caicedo took the armband last week. Is he really a captain? I thought he led by example. I thought he had a good game, but is he your captain long term? The Enzo Fernandez problem is a problem because we don't know if that incident happened over the summer. It's going to rear its head again at some point. And I don't know. I just don't personally, it doesn't sit me well, Enzo Fernandez being Chelsea captain. I've just got to be honest. He just doesn't strike me as the guy I want to be leading this team. For a variety of reasons, I think it's also performance related. I just don't think Enzo Fernandez has been good enough so far this season. You know, he doesn't strike me as that guy I want to be leading the team. So yeah, for me, Colwill to me seems like a bit of a no-brainer. But it's part of the issue we've got is that when you ask the question, who's the leader, everyone shrugs their shoulders. Especially if you're asking who other than Enzo Fernandez. So yeah, I'd give it to Colwill, and I hope that he takes that responsibility on his shoulders. I think the slight problem last year was I remember him having the armband maybe once or twice, or kind of there were talks about it, and I thought he had some really poor defensive performances where his lack of awareness cost us quite dearly in games.
Well, those are the games where he was playing in that fullback position where he was just getting absolutely burned at every single opportunity.
True. No, fair enough. I'm trying to think back. I feel like Kukurea might be playing right back. Because we had so many injury problems last year. The issue you got is clear with Reece James, right? I just made a show about it. Reece is a real issue in terms of his injury problems aren't stopping, and you can't have a club captain who plays like four times a season. Like, you look at the numbers, he played 11 times last year. I actually look at the numbers of his appearances, and they've been going down each year. So if that trend continues, he's going to be under 10 this year, which is obviously unworkable, right? You can't have a player like that, especially one that we know is as talented as Reece and is always framed as a huge Chelsea player. So you need someone who you can rely upon, who's going to be there 9 times out of 10. Mm. Actually, when you a captain needs to kind of be there 10 times out of 10, to be honest. So I feel like Levi is maybe that player. You've got to factor in that Levi has had some injury problems on his own, but I guess when you look across this squad, who hasn't had injury problems of their own? So yeah, I think it's a difficult problem. I'd like to see what would happen if Levi gets that armband for a long period of time. I feel like it sits well with more people that Levi's the captain than Enzo Fernandez personally.
I think it would for me as well. I mean, look, yeah, for me, I say the jury's still out purely because of what you've been saying, where I don't understand who the leaders are in this team. I don't see anyone go, oh yeah, that's clear enough his candidate. But people seem to see something in Levi Colwill, which I think suggests that people identify with him, which I think is also a big thing about captains of a football club. If you have someone that people can identify with, I think it unifies people.
And I think it kind of helps him a little bit that he doesn't have the 26 on his back anymore.
Yeah.
And because in some way, spiritually, I understand that it's nice, right? Like, there's a reason, but there also is a weight to that number. Like, clearly, you know, the guy who currently has the number 8 is also a problem. Like, to me, those numbers, maybe I'm more of a traditionalist than other people, but I, you know, those numbers do carry weight. It's a bit like Moises Caicedo being given a number 25. I mean, I thought that 25 was the number that was retired, basically, at Chelsea, and no one was going to have it. And I sometimes think it's unfair on that player as well, because it forces onto them. The problem is with the number 8 now. I mean, Oscar has had it, Ross Barkley's had it, Kovacic's had it, so it's lost its meaning at this point. Like, I'm not saying that it isn't Frank's number anymore, and the weight of Frank having that number is not the same as it was. I'm just saying, in terms of like it being bestowed down to someone, it doesn't really matter. Everyone's had a number 8 at this point, so it doesn't really matter.
It feels like, I reckon, with Enzo Fernandez, that was just a marketing ploy. Because obviously he had the number 5, didn't he? And he's like, we'll give you the number 8 because it's a big number for Chelsea. It was the same. You know, I've noticed this when Koulibaly took the 26. As you mentioned, Levi Colwill did. You know, there was a big furore around that because it was JT's number and how they called him to ask if it was okay, blah, 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 blah. Same with Caicedo having the 25. And to answer your question, yes, it was retired. Unofficially, but it was retired at Chelsea. That was always known, and whenever there's been past cases where the 25 has been asked for and they've gone, no, you can't have it. I mean, it might seem like a small thing, but I'm a man for minute details, and I still don't like the fact that Caicedo's got the 25. You know, you talk about the weight on players, etc., etc. I know it's small, and I know I've gone off on a tangent here a bit. I do feel that, like you said, those numbers carry weight, and that is something that needs to be
understood. But it gets back to what leadership is. Like, it's more than just, we're just giving you an armband. Like, when you take that role, that's one of the things that I think people maybe don't have appreciation of Azpilicueta, right? Like, because when you take that captain's armband, you're a leading figure when there are issues in the Premier League. You're basically the player rep for your club. You have to do a lot more media commitments. You have to do a lot more community commitments. You are seen as a spokesperson for the club. And of course, despite Azpilicueta, you know, when he left Chelsea, it was the right time. But from an off-pitch point of view, he was very well regarded as someone who was a great spokesperson for the club. And that's what you have to be as well. And that's the role that Levi or whoever takes the captain's armband has to take on. And that's slightly the issue that maybe we're talking about with Enzo Fernandez is, you know, is he that person out in the media with a lot more media than maybe there was 10 years ago, right? Like, it's more in the limelight than it was before. So you need to take that responsibility on. You need to be a beacon for the club. You need to be a positive beacon for the club, and you need to take that leadership role. So it's a tricky one, and no one really stands out at the moment. So a bit like some positions in the team, it kind of feels like a free-for-all, and whoever steps up is going to get it, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we'll just have to see what happens with that and as it develops and who will wear the armband for Chelsea this week, because realistically it's probably going to be Moises Caicedo again. But having said that, we've gone off on a big tangent there, so we should probably get straight back and focused on the show. Dan, let's get straight into the predicted 11. Now, we've mentioned that Reece James is unavailable, Mal Augusto potentially unavailable, Kieran Drewsby Hall and Enzo Fernandez both will have their names back in the hat after coming back from illness. So, Dan, let's start in goal. Robert Sanchez, I think it's pretty self-explanatory now.
Yeah,
let's go for that. Back four.
I'm going to call for it again. It probably isn't going to happen, but if Mal Augusto is not back, I don't want to see De Zassi there again. And I know he brought on Tosin late on to kind of play that role, but it's not really a good fix. Why not just promote Josh Akpom? Why I've heard over the summer is how much internally people rate him because of his work at the academy, because he's really impressed when he has been promoted to the first team. You have players in a squad for a reason, and it's kind of that classic thing I say about Cobham of fulfilling versatile and necessary squad roles, and that's what Akpom is there for. So why not try him at right back? I know it's a hostile environment, but it goes back to, if he isn't going to start in a Premier League game now, like, when's the point to start him? You're always going to come up with that excuse. If he can't play against West Ham, why can he play against Brighton? If he can't play against Brighton, why can't he play against Nottingham Forest? He's there for a reason. You've kept him in the squad for a reason. Let's use him and see if he's good enough. Because De Zassi, to me, has looked very wayward so far this season, and that's me being kind.
He's got the turning circle of an old tanker, hasn't he? It's just not.
Yeah, so it's not good enough. Maybe he started Vega last week, so maybe you can make the argument that Vega could even fulfill that role. I mentioned it earlier, Cucurella has played at right back for Chelsea before, whether Maresca does the same as Pochettino. But I'd prefer to see Akpom promoted and be given a chance at right back. I think it's a wild shout. I don't think it's going to happen. And if Gusto's fit, Gusto will play, rightly so. But I don't see why we wouldn't try him when we've got an injury problem in that area.
Okay, I will go with that then. So we're going Josh Akpom, right back, Cucurella, left back, Levi, and Fofana's two centre backs. I think that's fairly self-explanatory there. Midfield. Caicedo's obviously a shoo-in, as is Cole Palmer. Who takes that third slot, mate?
See, there's a... It's not that Fernandez can't do anything good on the ball, and I understand in terms of progressive passing, in terms of... We saw it in the Wolves game, right, where when Chelsea are firing and we're able to get the ball through the thirds convincingly, he can play a very big role in getting us on transition of playing those balls from a deeper position that can be really impactful. But unfortunately, that's happened in really only one half of football so far this season when he's been playing. The other games and for a longer period of time, Enzo Fernandez, for me, has been more of a question mark at Chelsea. I feel that Vega, just to me in this type of game, feels a bit more up for it. Like, I love that he loves a tackle. The bloke loves a tackle. Like, it feels like in his contract he has to have a certain number of tackles per game to get a bonus, and he loves it. So I just think in terms of just adding a bit more physicality to central midfield, we talked about the threats that West Ham have. I wouldn't mind seeing Vega and Caicedo again as a midfield too, just to give more security to that back four, which is a problem.
Well, Romeo Lavia might be available as well. Is this a game where you'd risk him potentially, or is it be a case of let's let this one, give him that extra week, given the issues that he faced last year?
Yeah, I mean, I can understand they probably want to be cautious, right? Because he's already had one setback this season. And because of, we talked about this before, the lack of midfield depth is quite scary. So you need to be very cautious in that area. And maybe you stumbled across, maybe not stumbled across, it was cited that Vega could play in midfield when we signed him. So let's go with him again. I thought he had a decent performance last week.
Okay, I like that. We'll go with that. Now the front three. You've been making your case for Christopher Nkunku. I'm still a big advocate for Nicholas Jackson there. And the flanks, I think Noni Madueke still picks himself. But that left side, as we have discussed, is very, very, very much open. What are we doing, Dan? Give me your case, please, for the front three.
So for my front three, I think Sancho will start again.
Agreed.
Kind of necessary after his performance. See, I could see that Maresca would probably think to himself again, Nkunku is a good impact player. And the argument maybe he makes that defences being tired against Nkunku is a good threat to have. But I just think Nkunku is a good finisher. I think he's a better finisher than Jackson. And I'm a big Jackson fan. You know, we've talked about this before. I'm a big Jackson fan. I'm like you. I'm a big advocate for Jackson. But I just feel that Nkunku can be a real difference maker. And if Chelsea maybe are under a bit of pressure in this game, he's a good transition player too. We know that. His speed is electric as well. So I think he's got that dual threat for Chelsea. So I'll go Nkunku and, like you, Madawake off the right.
And then you go on. Okay, so you're... Okay. Well, I am in the Enzo Maresca school of thought because I'm still very worried about his injury problems. And I think that he, in the games where he has come off the bench, he's been pivotal. So I'm going to go Nicholas Jackson as the only difference you and I have. Do you want to play a game of rock, paper, scissors to decide the Chelsea Echo 11?
Let's just go with Jackson.
Boo! You're so boring, Dan. You don't want to play rock, paper, scissors because you know you're going to lose.
Do you know what I think is a funnier game to play? Where is Joao Felix?
Shit, I hadn't even thought about that.
How quickly has he fallen off the radar, isn't it? And I have to say, it almost is a little bit like, well, yeah. Because he was awful off the bench. Like, let's just make it clear. He was quite terrible off the bench against Bournemouth. And, like, he's not coming into anyone's thinking. Unless you're, like, a massive Joao Felix fan, there's no justification for him starting any games with Chelsea at the moment. Other than, like, Barrow. He can start Barrow. He can start... Who are we playing in a week in the Conference League? He could start the Conference League game. I have no problem with that. But, like, any serious game at the moment, he's nowhere near it.
Blimey. Well... That says a lot, and that obviously is going to be very interesting to see how he fits into the plans of Chelsea going forward. I think maybe off the bench against West Ham, he might have a bit more fun, because that is obviously where he actually had a pretty good debut there. You know, because that was where he made his debut, West Ham, wasn't it? His second debut.
He returned.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, his second debut after the red card, his first full game of football for Chelsea. So, I mean, guys, let us know your thoughts. Does João Felix factor into your thinking? We'd be very interested to hear what you think of where he fits in this team, because as you can clearly hear by me and Dan, neither him or I are very sure where he is. But with all that being said, we should probably hand over now to the big bald man who sits in the press area, and we're going to get you the quotes from Enzo Maresca at the press conference.
Reece still out. Has there been a delay? And if so, it's a tough one, isn't it? How will the club manage this with Reece?
Waiting that he's fit. Waiting that he's fit. His injury, it's a bit delay. But the most important thing for him, but for any injury, is that they are back, or they come back when they are 100% fit. And Reece is still out. In terms of injury in the past, we always hope that we can find the right solution. In this case, has been very unlucky, because we planned to change him after 65 minutes and he was getting injured after 62, 63, so it was also a bit unlucky. But hopefully we can have him back soon as possible.
Is this squad good enough, do you think, to challenge and get in the top four this season?
I said already, no one, since I met the first time the owners and the sport director, they never mentioned me to finish top four, and the target was top four.
But do you think the squad's good enough to finish top four?
I think this is a good squad, but I also said that if the last 2 years we finish 12 and we finish 6, to improve is not something automatic. You need progress. You need progress. Yeah, you need progress. So I think the squad is good, but the only way to reach some important target like top four, just to try to be focused on game after game. Otherwise, if you think about April, May, it's too far.
Okay, you're both right. Hello.
Yeah. So we've seen Sancho's impact in a short appearance. You've got a few options on the left. We've seen Neto play very impressive on the right at Wolves. Is that an option for you to put him alongside Nonny?
I will, hopefully I can clarify. So as a left winger, we have Jadon and Misha. As a right winger, we have Nonny and Pedro. As attacking midfielder, we have Joao and Cole. As a number 9, we have Nicolas and Cristo. There are not so many players We have two players each position. Now, Cristo can play as a nine, can play attacking midfielder, he can play winger. Yes. Kenan Disburiol can play pocket and can play wide. Yes. And then Pedro was playing like left winger because Jadon was not here, was not fit, and Misha, between him and Jadon and Pedro, I prefer Pedro for that game. That means that I will prefer always Pedro. But in terms of position, we have Misha and Jadon, Pedro and Noni in the right side. Then we have Cole, Joao, Cristo and Nico in front. So the squad is quite clear in terms of position.
Well, Cobham is one of the best academies in the world. We've got Josh Achiampong, who's a right-back, incredible right-back. You've had some issues in the right-back area. Is he actually ready to get minutes? Is he ready to be involved in the squad?
Josh, I really like Josh. Yeah. For me, potentially, he can be top player, top defender for the future. Now, with young players, I have quite experience, and I like to modify them a little bit, because today, for the young players, they can change very quick. They can quick think that they are so good or so bad. So I think you need to be, you need to moderate a little bit the way they join us.
When he and Nkunku came in at more or less the same time, it, I think it seemed like Nkunku was the established player that was coming in, and Jackson was kind of the young kid who had lots to learn. Sort of almost feels like their status in the squad has been reversed this season. Is that kind of how you see it?
No, the only thing I can say is that Cristo last year was injured. So the reason why probably Nicolas was ahead of Cristo also for this reason. Then this season, since we start, in the way we play, we start to use Nicolas. But as I said, that means that we are not going to use Mark or Cristo as a nine. Depends on the games. In this moment, Nicolas, we are very happy with him and he's doing very well. And also, I think in terms of numbers, last year and this season, it's already on important numbers.
Quotes were said rather than numbers. Lineups were given to you. Numbers were said. Thoughts were processed. This has been the Chelsea Echo. Dan, it's been a pleasure as always. Him and I will be back, of course, next week for the preview of the big fixture in the Premier League, as well as talking a little bit about Barrow. But him and I are also going to be very busy moving flats on the same day. So I'll be giving you your match review as I move things around in my flat. Tom will be giving you the numbers. And the notorious PIE will return, but it will be a substitute appearance by a friend of mine who is taking my ticket for the game. Because don't worry, there are more tickets available for West Ham than there are for Bournemouth. But Dan, pleasure as always. Good luck measuring things up tomorrow as you listen to the game, as I will be as well.
Likewise.
This has been the Chelsea Echo. Make sure you give us a 5-star review if you have enjoyed the show. If you haven't enjoyed the show, make sure you tell us why. And you can follow us on our socials and send us death threats. I've been Louis, that's been Dan, and we'll see you later. Ta-da.